Hello, everyone. Welcome to Skype a Scientist Live. This week is all about brains. We're doing all neuroscience this week because we have partnered up with the Philadelphia chapter for the Society for Neuroscience. And fun fact, if you didn't already know, Skype a Scientist is currently based in Philadelphia. Our HQ is in Philly in the neighborhood called Fishtown. So we're so glad to have you all here. We're super excited to talk about brains. And today our guest is Russ Bono, and he's known as the Brain Dude. So we are pumped to learn about brains. And so today we're gonna have a about 15 minute presentation from Russ, and then we'll go into our typical Q&A. If you have questions throughout the presentation, please use our Q&A format, which you'll see right at the bottom here, to type your questions in, and then we'll get to them after the presentation. If it's really important to you that you have Erin, our ASL interpreter, play around with your view that you see. And you can kind of play with your settings to make sure that all of us are visible during Russ's presentation. And if for whatever reason it's not working, rest assured it will be on our YouTube channel afterward, and Erin will be visible in that posted video. I think we're ready to go. So Russ, do you want to introduce yourself, say who you are, what you do, why you like it, and then start showing us some cool stuff?
Absolutely. So first, let me say thanks to Skype a Scientist for the invite. It's really great to be with you on Zoom. I usually do this presentation for the past 20 years in person with my brain material in nice little jars that people can pick up and hold and look at. But today we're going to do this virtually, and it's the first time for Dr. Brain Dude ever. So my name's Dr. Russ Bono, or Dr. Brain Dude. I'm a full professor at Cooper Medical School of Rowan University, which is in Camden, New Jersey. I also have appointments at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia and Thomas Jefferson University of Philadelphia as well. I teach medical students for the past 20 years brains and brain anatomy. My research specialty is in genetics, and I'm especially interested in the genetics of human epilepsy, human substance abuse, and human diseases such as schizophrenia and bipolar disorder. So my main focus has been in epilepsy for the past decades or more, and that's where most people know me from. But what I'd like to do for you today is just introduce you to the brain. What I'm going to do now is I'm going to share my screen with you, and you can see I have some gloves on. And what I'm going to do is take you through some different animal brains first, and talk a little bit about what animals do best and how you can see that in their brain anatomy. And then I'm going to slowly work my way up to a human brain, show you a human brain, and talk a little bit about it. And then I will go ahead and let you folks ask any questions that I might be able to try and answer for you. So I'm gonna share my screen now to get rid of my face. And I'm gonna show you what's under my camera, which is a squishy stress brain, just for my focusing aid. And of course, the shameless plug for my medical school on the brain. So what I'd like to start with is some animal brains for you. And here I have a tray, and I'm gonna reduce my zoom. A little bit better. What I have here is some wet paper towels covering my specimens. And the first specimen I'm going to show you off here to the left. And you can see him. Probably all recognize him. He's a crab. I found him on the beach. He was dead. And I picked him up and brought him home, put him in a jar. And I always ask people the question, if I took the back of this crab off, would he have a brain in there? Does he have a brain that looked like that brain? And of course, the answer is no. If you take the crab's back off, what you will find inside the crab is not a brain, but rather a group of nerve cells that are connected to each other like a net. He has a nerve net. So he doesn't have a brain, but he certainly has a lot of the same behaviors that you and I have. When he's hungry, he goes and looks for food and hunts. When you challenge him, he will use his great big claws to defend himself. And when the time is right, he will make more crab babies. So he does a lot of the same things that we do. Reproduction, survival, defensive nature, feeding. So even without a brain, this animal is able to do a lot of the same things that we do. I'm going to move over to the next brain I'm going to show comes from a mouse. This is the brain of a mouse. And a mouse only weighs about 20 grams. A mouse is small, like your finger. So imagine his skull is small, and he can only get in his skull the amount of brain that you can fit. And so here is the little mouse brain. And you can see my pointer is pointing to the front of the brain where these two little bumps are. And now I'm pointing toward the back of the brain where the cerebellum is. You can actually see a little line going across here that separates the cerebellum from the cerebrum. The cerebrum is the big brain, the cerebellum is the little brain. I'm going to peel this back a little bit more to reveal the next brain. And this is a rat. This is the brain from a rat. Now, a rat is about 10 times the size of a mouse. If a mouse weighs 20 grams, a rat weighs almost 300 or more. And now you can clearly see the division between his cerebrum, big brain up front, and his cerebellum. Bumps up front. These two little bumps up front are connected to the rat's nose. And as you might imagine, rats are out at night. They're nocturnal creatures. And they don't see very well, but they smell very well. And they've got these nice bulbous structures. Mouse, you can see those little bulbs, and that helps them with their sense of smell. Take a look at the next specimen. This is a rabbit's brain. Now you can see the cerebrum and the smaller cerebellum in the back. And here you can actually even see a little bit of the animal's spinal cord that would go down his backbone. And now notice the two bulbs up front. Here's the rabbit's sense of smell. And you can see that these two big bulbs are really big. I'm going to show you the next brain from an animal called a possum. Possums are like great big rats, and they like to come to my backyard at night and eat the bird seed from my bird feeder. And they have terrible eyesight. Look at their nose prongs. They're huge. Almost 10% of this animal's brain is devoted to its sense of smell. And you can just see that in the anatomy. Great big olfactory bulbs for smelling. You can see the cerebellum. Here. Now, the last one I want to show you is a whole head of an animal, so be prepared. This is the whole head of a bird. This is a bird known as a pheasant. And you can see the beak, and you can see his great big eye. And if I turn this around, I will show you his brain in his skull. Bring back here. Here's his cerebrum. And here's his cerebellum. But notice the thing that this animal does the best is see. Birds have great sense of vision. And look how big his eyes are. His eyes take up most of his skull. And in fact, most birds don't even have a sense of smell. So this animal doesn't even have a sense of smell. So whereas this animal depends heavily on his sense of smell, and you can see it in the way his brain is built, this animal doesn't have any smell at all, but really depends. Big eyes are what lead the way. Now, all of these animals I've shown you have something in common. That is, they don't look like what we expect to see a brain. We expect to see a brain with lots of bumps and grooves, lots of. Looks pretty smooth. It looks very smooth.
I'm going to show you a cat and a dog.
So here's the cat's brain. And you can see this brain is not smooth. This brain has lots of bumps and grooves in it. And the dog similarly has lots of bumps and grooves in his brain. And we think that this is what helps make you smart, the number of bumps and grooves you have in your brain. So some animals have smooth brains, whereas some animals like cats and dogs have very bumpy brains. I'm going to show you one more on this tray. Be prepared. This is a whole brain from a white-tailed deer, and his eyes are still attached. I wanted you to remember that your eyes are attached to your brain as well. So here is the white-tailed deer's brain, his great big cerebrum, his little cerebellum in the back, and here are his eyes. And the eyes are attached to the brain through the nerves, optic nerves. And this is the same as your brain. So now imagine, we think the thing that makes you smarter is a bumpy brain versus a smooth brain. Why might that be? Well, if you think about it, I'm going to give you a little demo here. I hope you can see me up in the corner. I have a little paper towel here. Imagine this paper towel is all the brain tissue I was ever going to get. And I tried to fit it inside my skull, but it doesn't fit. So imagine if I took my brain and I did this. I crumpled it up. Then I could get all of this brain inside my skull, plus a lot more. So animals that have bumps in their brain have actually more brain tissue in their skull. And the more brain tissue you have, the more brain cells you have. And the more brain cells you have, the smarter you are. Now, that's not to say birds aren't smart or that mice aren't smart. If you try to catch a mouse, he's pretty clever. But they're not quite as smart as these animals. So for instance, a rabbit likes to go around and eat and make more rabbits. But a cat, if you've ever watched a cat is a predator. A cat will hunt. And cats will also take time to play. They like catnip and they like fuzzy balls and they chase things around. Cats look for affection from humans when they want it. Dogs similarly can do tricks for you where a mouse or a rat aren't necessarily interested in that for you. All right, so smooth brains and bumpy brains, that's a big distinction. The other thing that we think that makes animals smart is the size of their brain in relation to the size of their body. The brain to body weight ratio is what makes some animals very smart. So imagine I have the same brain size as a hippopotamus does, but I'm not quite as big as a hippopotamus. At least not yet. I'm trying to not eat so much. That hippopotamus has a great big body that he has to run with that brain. And he has to use all of his brain just to run that great big body. But my brain's the same size as his. And my body's not the same size as his. So I have brain left over to do things that humans do that hippopotamus don't. Like language, like music, like dance, like building things and engineering, all of the things that make us human. Make us human because we have a lot of bumps and grooves in our brain, we have a lot of brain tissue, and we have a really big brain for the size of our body. I want to give you another example of this from the animal world. So I'm going to show you the brain of a dolphin, and the dolphin's brain is actually in a jar. So I'm going to bring the jar over. I'm just going to lay the jar down on it so that you can see this great big brain. And I'm going to reduce my zoom just a little. Now, when I got this dolphin's brain, it was in three pieces. And I used some orange rubber bands to piece it back together again. So that's what you're seeing, the orange rubber bands. But here's a great big brain with this great big cerebrum up front. Up in here, and his littler cerebellum back here. And he has a lot of bumps and grooves in his brain, just as much as humans do. Now, this is from a short-beaked dolphin. That's a species of dolphin that grows to about 5 to 7 feet in the wild. I'm about 6 feet tall. And this dolphin has a brain that's just as big as mine, maybe even a little bigger. And I'm going to show you now the whole head of a small shark.
I want to show you the shark's head. Here's a shark's head. You can see his eye. And you can see his mouth, sharp teeth. And this little fan shark will grow to about 3 or 4 feet long in the wild. But what he does is he grows a pointy little head. And if I do the dissection, I will show you. Little white structure here that I'm poking on, this little thing about the size of a kidney bean, is his brain. That's all he gets for a brain. So imagine this animal grows almost to the size of this animal, but this animal grows a great big head and fills it with a brain, whereas this animal grows a skinny pointy head and doesn't fill it with a brain. He's got a small brain. Again, if we think about the behavior of these two animals, sharks are kind of like rabbits. They kind of swim around and eat, and they make more sharks. They don't do a whole lot more. Whereas dolphins have lots of behaviors. Dolphins have language. Dolphins each have a name. Dolphins address each other by their name when they meet. Dolphins live in pods. They take time out to play. They surf with surfers and they ride along the bows of ships. Dolphins take care of other sick dolphins in their pod when they get sick. Dolphins display a lot of the same things that humans do. In fact, it's even been suggested that dolphins chew on pufferfish to get a little high. And there are videos of dolphins sharing pufferfish with each other as if it was recreational drugs. Maybe having such a smart brain also comes with some problems that you have to be careful of. These great big dolphins have the best brain to body weight ratio on the planet. Humans come in a very close second. So we think dolphins are at least as smart as people. And I've met some dolphins that I think are maybe even smarter than some people I've met. Okay, I'm going to bring you now to a human brain. I have my human brain now covered with a washcloth. I'm going to remove the washcloth. And what you see isn't a brain. When you open up somebody's skull, the first thing you see is actually this very thick membrane. This membrane is like canvas, feels like the jeans you wear. And it's called the dura mater. In Latin, it means the tough mother. And it's a membrane that helps protect your brain. It lines the inside of your skull. It has cells in it and blood vessels in it. It's a living tissue. And this dura mater, this tough mother, is one of the protective layers of your brain. It's also called one of the meninges. If you've ever heard of meningitis is an infection of this layer of your brain by bacteria or a virus or a fungus. And that's very bad if you get bacteria or fungus or virus here because it has direct access to the tissue below it, the human brain. Here is an adult human brain. I'm going to zoom out just a little. Here is an adult human brain. It weighs about 3.5 to 4 pounds. And you can see all of the bumps and grooves, all of the gyri, foci, the human brain. This is the front of the brain. This great structure is the cerebrum. Here is the cerebellum in the back of the brain. And here is the actual spinal cord coming off of the brain. So we like to tell people this is the main computer inside your head. And this is the main cable that connects it up to the rest of your body. Every time you move a muscle or get a feeling, that feeling has to travel up this wire into your brain so you can figure out what you're feeling. And every time you want to move a muscle, that movement starts in your brain and then goes down this cable to the muscles in your body to affect that movement. So
So here we have the adult human brain. 3.5 to 4 pounds, as I said. The front of the brain is known as the frontal lobe, and the frontal lobe is about emotion and behavior. The frontal lobe is where you get your crowd-pleasing personality. The next part of the brain is the parietal lobe on the top. The parietal lobe is really your thinking cap. This is where all the thinking happens. So when you see a brain, it's think and do. You think about stuff in your parietal lobe, you send the information to your frontal lobe, and your frontal lobe makes a decision on how to act. So frontal lobe is action and emotion and behavior, whereas parietal lobe is how you piece everything together. So for instance, if I'm walking through the woods and I hear the bush next to me rattle, and I look over to the bush and I see the rattling bush and I see a large brown figure and I decide, oh, that's a bear, I should do something. I send that information to my frontal lobe, and the frontal lobe says, that's a bear, you should run. And I run. This structure here, my fingers are digging into a little bit, is called the temporal lobe. Temporal lobe is next to your temples, and it's next to your ears. It has something to do with hearing. And inside your temporal lobe, there's a very important structure called the hippocampus. The hippocampus is about the size and shape of my pinky. Runs the full length of the temporal lobe. And the hippocampus is very important for learning and memory. All of the things you learn today will be stored inside your hippocampus. And when you go to sleep at night, your hippocampus transfers these short-term memories to long-term storage up here in your thinking cap, in your parietal lobe. It's very important to get a good night's sleep. Learning and memory depends on good sleep, because sleep is when you take short-term memories in the temporal lobe and store them long-term in your thinking cap, in your parietal lobe. The back of the cerebrum is called the occipital lobe, and the occipital lobe is all about vision. So your eyeballs are out here in the front of your skull, the visual information comes all the way back here to the occipital lobe. And the occipital lobe isn't telling you what you see, rather it's the raw information of vision, color, contrast, movement, shape, edges. All of that raw information is sent here to the thinking cap. So you look up in the sky, you see the color and the shape and the movement, and your thinking cap says, oh, that's a red-tailed hawk. I've seen that before. I know what that is.
Now,
the little brain in the back.
Flip the brain over.
Move the spinal cord out of the way.
I'll show you the little brain in the back.
Cerebellum. The cerebellum actually has more cells in it than the cerebrum does. Look how folded it is. It's so densely folded. There are lots and lots of cells in there. And the cerebellum is mostly involved with movement, helping you make movements, smooth movements, walking and lifting things, pointing things, playing sports. So the cerebellum helps you with movement, and it especially helps you with movement that you don't think about. Sitting in a chair, riding a bike, walking up steps. These are things that you've developed muscle memory for, and those muscle memories are stored in the cerebellum. So you don't have to think about those kind of movements. Your body can just do them for you. You'll hear it happen a lot where a professional athlete will say, I had a terrible night because I was thinking too much, or I had a great night because I was in the zone. The cerebellum is the zone of the brain that allows you to do repetitive movement, like throwing a baseball or hitting a golf ball, the same way with consistency. So movement and consistency versus thinking and higher level functions in the cerebrum. Now remember, movement can express emotion. You've gone to the dance or to the ballet, you've seen people express emotion through their movement. Therefore, the part of the brain, the cerebellum, that controls movement is attached to the part of the brain that controls emotion and behavior. So your frontal lobe is connected to your cerebellum.
Last thing I'll show you
is this spinal cord as it comes out. And where the spinal cord enters the brain is called the brain stem. This region is a very important region known as the brain stem. Where my pointer is now is called the medulla oblongata. And the medulla oblongata is that part of your brain that makes your heart beat and makes you breathe without thinking about it. So you don't go to bed at night and say, oh, it'd be a good idea if I kept my heart beating all night. Your brain does that for you. And this part of the brain, the medulla oblongata, is what does that for you. The next part of the brain up is called the pons. In Latin, the pons means a bridge. And you can see that the bridge is actually connecting the little brain to the big brain. So it's a bridge between the cerebellum and the cerebrum. And it's how they are able to talk to each other.
Now I'm going to show you a couple of things on the bottom of this brain.
This little wire that I'm going to hold up on my pointer right here, that is your olfactory bulb. So imagine how big that was in a possum or a rat. And look how small it is in a human. You have wires are how your sense of smell actually come into your brain. Now they look very small, but remember, sense of smell is very important. And your sense of smell is actually connected to your memory system. If you ever smelled a really bad, sour bottle of milk, you know it's terrible and you shouldn't drink it. And your nose tells you, don't drink that. That's bad for you. Your smell can also bring back other memories that are good. So when I go visit my grandma and I walk through the front door, I smell grandma's cookies. And I am all warm because I know how good grandma's cookies are. But my sense of smell is even more connected to my brain. It connects to a part of my brain that makes my gut start to move, that makes me make saliva in my mouth. I'm not only thinking about grandma's cookies, I'm gonna eat grandma's cookies. And so that sense of smell helps me get ready to eat with saliva and gut motion. So your brain is super complicated. The most complicated thing we know of in our world and maybe our universe. How this brain tissue forms consciousness and who you are as a person, I can't tell you. No one can tell you. It's that complicated. But it's one of the most fun things you can do in the whole world is to try to study it and figure it out. I'm going to show you two last brain samples before we stop.
If you took a knife and you cut this brain right down the middle, you know what you would get?
You would get a half a brain.
Here, that brain is cut in half, that long spinal cord.
This spinal cord goes all the way down to your belly button. And you can see the nerves that come and go like this giant computer cable.
If you come up the spinal cord,
here's that medulla oblongata, keeping your heart beating and breathing.
Here is that
pons connecting you to the rest of the brain.
And then there are lots of
structures inside here that have names and functions. When you come to my medical school, I will teach them all to you.
Here is the
cerebellum in the back. And if you look at it closely, it looks like the leaves of a plant. In fact, the ancient anatomists called this the folia of the cerebellum, for the foliage of the trees. I'm just going to zoom in a little bit for you here.
And you can see
that leaf-like pattern, highly folded.
This is the thalamus of the brain,
main relay station.
You know,
of a hole here in the brain. This is called a ventricle. The brain has holes in it naturally that make the cerebrospinal fluid. So your brain isn't floating in your skull in blood. It actually filters the blood into a special fluid called cerebrospinal fluid that surrounds the whole brain and the spinal cord and keeps it safe.
So why is it
that I study the brain? I'm mostly interested in trying to help people who have various diseases of the brain. And so I'm just going to show you one more sample of an example of a brain disease. I'm going to show you two half brains from two men who were in their 80s when they died. And they were both the same height and weight, and one of them had very bad Alzheimer's disease, whereas the other one did not. I'm going to show you these two brains. So the notice here on the bottom, this is the normal brain. And you can see that it's nice and plump and full. If I turn it over onto the medial surface, again, you can see it's a nice, full, plump brain. This is what your brain should look like.
But this is what happens in someone with Alzheimer's disease. This brain is shriveling up like a raisin. Cells inside the brain die. I turn this brain around. How much smaller it is, how many more spaces there are in the brain.
There's a lot more holes and spaces in this brain. So Alzheimer's is a disease where cells in the brain begin to die. We don't know why. What we do know is that the first cells that start to die are in that hippocampus. So people with Alzheimer's disease, the first thing they start to find is that they're losing their short-term memories. These are people who will drive their car to Walmart and forget how to go home. Eventually, it gets so bad, these people can get lost in their own home. So we're very interested in trying to understand how brains work and how we might be able to fix them when they don't work well.
Okay, I'm going to stop the presentation of brains there.
And I'm going to stop sharing my screen. Okay.
All so right.
That was a cool presentation. No?
That was super awesome. I literally had no idea what a possum brain looked like, and that was shocking to me. That was really, really cool. I have a possum that lives right near my house, and I see it all the time, and I love possums. That's really cool. Okay, so we have a lot of questions that have come in. So one of the questions that came on early on was about epilepsy. So you said that you study epilepsy. First of all, could you tell us a little bit more about exactly what epilepsy is and how it affects your brain?
Yes, so epilepsy is when someone has abnormal electrical activity in their brain. They have too much electricity in their brain. And what happens is some people will fall on the floor and have a seizure where their muscles convulse and their eyes close, and it looks really scary. When you talk to a patient after they wake up and you say, that was really scary, did it hurt? They don't even know it happened. They don't feel any pain. They don't know what happened to them. There's another kind of epilepsy where the abnormal electrical activity gets so much in the brain that people don't fall on the floor and shake, but instead their brain kind of short circuits and they just stop. They become absent. The French word is absence, and it's called absence epilepsy. So epilepsy comes in two flavors. One, you kind of just go blank, and imagine this is not good. What if you go blank when you're at the top of the stairs, or you're driving a car, or you're in the bathtub? So this can be very dangerous for people with epilepsy. If you fall on the floor and have convulsions, this is very scary for the people who witness it and can also be very problematic, again, if you're swimming or you're at the top of the steps or driving. So for many years, I've been collecting blood and brain tissue from people with epilepsy and sequencing their DNA to see if I can find problems in their genes that help predispose them to get their disease.
Super cool. So have you found specific like gene markers that you can say, okay, this person is going to have epilepsy or anything like that?
Correct. So in some people with epilepsy, a single gene mutation can lead to their disease. But this is very rare. Less than 1% of the people who go to the hospital go because they have a single gene that gave them epilepsy. 99% of the people who come to the hospital, it's because they have multiple genes that are subtly varied that increase their risk for having a seizure. And then something in their environment may help trigger it. Diet, sleep deprivation, alcohol consumption, work schedule. In some women, the timing of their menstrual periods and changes in hormones. So these kind of environmental cues, along with the genes you've inherited, we think is what makes people have various brain diseases, not just epilepsy, but Alzheimer's, schizophrenia, multiple sclerosis, you name it. Most of these diseases are not caused by a single gene, rather multiple gene variations and some environmental factors.
Awesome. Well, thanks for sharing that with us. Raghav wants to know, where do we stand on treating diseases like Alzheimer's?
So lots of research going on. And as I teach my medical students in Western medicine, there are typically three approaches to try to heal someone. There's pharmacology, drugs. There's surgery, trying to help. And then there's behavior modification. Guess which one's the hardest?
Behavior.
So if I run into a patient and they're having trouble with their weight, I say to them, you have to stop eating so much. And they say, can't you just give me a pill? Or maybe you can do surgery on my stomach. With Alzheimer's disease, there is no good surgery for this. And there's so the other two things that you try is behavior modification. So what we're telling people is that your brain is like any muscle in the body. And if you work it, you can make it stronger. When it comes to Alzheimer's disease, what we've found is that there's a large correlation between your education and whether or not you get Alzheimer's disease. And that's not formal education. That doesn't mean you have to go to school and get lots and lots of degrees. What it means is that if you keep your brain active, every time you learn something and do something new, your brain forms more connections, synapses. And what we think is happening is when you get older, you start to lose synapses. You start to lose your ability to do things. For people with Alzheimer's, eventually they lose their ability to do the activities of daily living, dressing themselves, feeding themselves, toileting themselves. And what we think is happening is that they're losing too many synapses. Their brain won't work anymore. So what we're telling people is in their 40s and 50s and 60s is to make more synapses, learn a foreign language, pick up a musical instrument, do Sudoku, do things that your brain isn't used to, novel things, and you will make more connections. And then when you get old, maybe you'll be able to give up connections and still function. And what we find is that people who have a lot of connections, we call it a cognitive reserve, those people seem to be protected from Alzheimer's. So modify your behavior, make your brain stronger with more connections, and you will protect yourself. Of course, the other big front in Alzheimer's is, are there drugs that can help? And right now, there are several drugs on the market, but they really don't help very much. And so people continue to do research to try to come up with new drugs. In the interim, we try to tell people, make your brain stronger. That will help protect you.
Cool. So what, sorry, my cat's being a bit much. What are those
drugs? Cat, I have a brain from a cat. I'm sorry.
I know. we try not to tell him what we've seen today. What do those drugs target exactly? Like, what are they even trying to block or promote or what?
So your brain works with chemicals mostly, things called neurotransmitters. And a lot of the Alzheimer's drugs are trying to modify the neurotransmitters in your brain. One big neurotransmitter in your brain is something called acetylcholine. And some of the drugs try to keep acetylcholine around longer and prevent it from being degraded so that your brain can utilize it for communication more. There are other drugs that try to target different neurotransmitter systems as well. This is the main thrust of what most of the drugs out there are trying to do. Until we understand why the cells are dying, we won't be able to make drugs to stop them from dying. So we just try to make the ones that haven't died communicate with each other better.
Gotcha. That makes sense. Cool. So Enrique would like to know, hi, Dr. Russ, is there a physical change in the brain in response to substance abuse?
So this is a great question. People have looked at many different diseases to look with MRIs and CAT scans to see if they can see an actual structural difference in the brain of people who have concussions or people who have autism or people who have any of these diseases. And bottom line is, it's not very obvious. You don't really see big structural differences in people's brains. What you see is more functional differences. that certain parts of the brain just doesn't work as well as it does in people who we consider normal. And again, what is normal and what is not normal? So we don't like to use that word. Everyone has their own brain that works in its own way. But it doesn't seem that people who have various diseases have major structural differences in their brain. There are some studies out there in schizophrenia and other places where some amounts of white matter or gray matter or less or more in certain people, but not something that's really well documented. In epilepsy, there are people who have a form of epilepsy that forms in their temporal lobe. And it's clear when you do MRI on these people that parts of their temporal lobe are shrinking, they're dying. So it depends on the disease and it depends on the part of the brain.
Sounds good. We've got a question from Mila, who's 7 years old. I have third nerve palsy. Does that affect my brain in any way? And do you think there will ever be a cure for it? And for those of us who don't know what that is, could you tell us what exactly third palsy is?
Correct. So the third nerve is the cranial nerve number 3. There are 12 of them. And these nerves are important for working things in your head, like smell and taste and vision. The third cranial nerve is really important for how your eyes move around. They control the muscles that move your eyeballs. And so a third nerve palsy means that that nerve isn't working as good as it could. And so the eye movements aren't as good as they could be. Nothing wrong with the brain. Brain is absolutely fine. It's just that that nerve, that wire, isn't working as good as it could. And there are some people doing a lot of research to figure out if they can surgically fix this. And of course, there are some exercises I'm sure that they've been encouraging her to do to try to strengthen those muscles and strengthen that connection. So a palsy just means that something's weak, weaker than it should be. And in this case, the nerve that helps move the eyes around is just a little bit weaker. So this is a problem. It might lead to double vision once in a while, or might make the eyes look a little bit off once in a while. But there's absolutely nothing wrong with your brain. Your brain's just as smart as mine, probably smarter.
Awesome. That's cool. The next question is, how many brains do you have? I'm assuming that means like how many different brains do you have in jars, et cetera, not how many brains, you just have one in your head.
Yeah, I have one poorly functioning brain in my skull. And I have a lot of different brains. I have a brain from a horse, and I have a brain from a cow. I have a brain from a lot of the animals that I showed you already, and a few more in the collection, probably about 20 or 25 total. They're not always easy to get. Some of these animals were actually killed on the road by cars, and we took them home and took their brains out. The dolphin brain was actually very difficult to get. Dolphins are protected marine mammals. You're not allowed to touch them according to federal law. And so I had to go through the National Atmospheric and Oceanographic Association, NOAA, to get my dolphin brain. It took 3 years, and this poor animal was hit by a boat and killed near Atlantic City. And the Brigantine Marine Mammal Stranding Center collected the brain for me. And it's my most popular brain. People love the dolphin brain.
That's cool. Here's an interesting question. What happens in the brain that causes hallucination during sleep paralysis?
So that's a great question. We think that the connection between your frontal, parietal, occipital lobes are all active when you're asleep. And you know that when you sleep, you have dreams. And hallucinations are related to dreaming. So those parts of the brain that help drive your dreams are also those parts of your brain that help drive hallucinations. And remember, hallucinations can be visual or auditory. So if you're hearing voices, then all the structures in your brain related to hearing are involved. You're seeing things, all of the structures in your brain related to vision are involved. And so sleep paralysis is a very specific thing that happens to some people. They wake up, let me put it to you this way. When you go into REM sleep and you dream at night, you don't want to act out your dreams. Imagine if I was swimming in the ocean and a shark attacked me, I would fight back. But I don't want to fight back in my bed. I might hurt my wife, she sleeps next to me.
Right.
And so when you're dreaming, your body actually paralyzes itself. so that you don't act out your dreams. And people with sleep paralysis wake up while their body is still paralyzed. It's very scary. And sometimes in that in-between waking up and not waking up, you're in a dreamy kind of state. That's where these hallucinations come from. They're just like dreams.
That's super cool and super weird. I've never had that, and I hope I never will, because it seems very spooky.
It turns out there's a disease in people where they can't paralyze their bodies. And when they go into REM sleep, they do act out their dreams, and they do damage to themselves and their bed partners and such. This is a disease related to Parkinson's disease and Lewy body dementia, it's called. And it can be a very serious thing.
That's super interesting. So we try to keep these sessions to be about 45 minutes, and we've already gone a minute over because we've had so many questions. So we always ask people the same two questions at the end of all of our sessions. The first question is, if you had the attention of everyone in the world, and you could tell them one thing related to neuroscience, what would you tell them?
Well, I would tell them that their brain is the coolest thing they own, and they should take care of it as best they can. And for me, it's a lifelong pursuit of studying the most complex thing in the world. It's fun.
Awesome. And then if you had, you still have everyone's attention in the world, you could tell them one thing about literally anything. It can be as serious and big picture or silly as you'd like.
I would just tell people in today's world to be kind. Be kind to each other.
That's very good advice. We all could use a little kindness, particularly these days. So is there anything that you'd like to plug? And are there places online that we can find you if people have more questions?
Dr. Brain Dude is actually a name I was given by a sixth grader many years ago. I had done my brain presentation at her school, and she met me in the local mall that weekend with her mom and forgot my name. And she wanted to introduce me, and she said, "This is Dr. Brain Dude." It was the nicest name anyone's ever called me, so I've stolen it. And for the last 20 years, Dr. Brain Dude is in a lot of places. In Philadelphia, we're at the Franklin Institute every year. I'm invited to the American Academy of Neurology every year to present at their brain fair, which is held in different cities across the country. In different city each year. I do probably two Dr. Brain Dudes a month when schools are in session and we can pass around the jars of possum brains and talk about things. So Brain Dude's been a great fun trip for me for the last 20 years or so. And I've probably touched, I would say 30 to 40,000 people have interacted with me and the brains over that course of time. And it's funny, I'll go out into the community and somebody will say, "I remember you. You brought a brain to my seventh grade class, and I haven't slept good since." Or I turned into a nurse or a doctor or a scientist. It really helped spark my interest. So yeah.
That's awesome. That's really cool. Well, hopefully we can connect again once we're allowed to leave our houses after.
Absolutely. And I'm happy if anyone has questions to reach out to my email. I'm happy to answer more if people have questions.
Great. Okay. Sounds good. And so everybody who's watching, this is just the first session of Brain Week. Tomorrow at 1 p.m., we're going to be talking with Dr. Sarah Ward. And then on Friday, again at 1 p.m. Eastern, we're talking to Vishnu Murthy. So these are two other brain scientists that are in Philadelphia. So we hope to see you there. Bring all your curiosity and questions to those sessions as well. Erin, thank you for signing for us. Russ, thank you for joining us. This has been super, super fun. And if anyone would like to share this video, it'll be up on YouTube in a couple hours. And now I'm going to go vote early, because in Philadelphia we can do that. And I am very
You're welcome, and thank you for having me. And come back for Sarah tomorrow. She's great. And take care.
All right. Thank you so much. Bye.
Bye.